TD News. I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information is available at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTV. I'm Gregory Berg. We hear from two authors today. The first author is responsible for a beautiful memoir called Table for Five. The second author has written a very intriguing book about anxiety. Here's part one. In this portion of WGTD's morning show, we're going to be talking about an inspiring and also heartbreaking story told by author Ted Yang in a book called Table for Five, a father's story of life, love, and loss. It is the story of Ted Yang and his wife Christine, and his wife Christine becoming pregnant with triplets, and then the very difficult turn for the worse when one of those triplets, Raymond, begins to physically fail and ultimately passes away. The triplets were born just 24 weeks into the pregnancy, so seriously premature. And this is a plight that, of course, a number of people have experienced in one way or another. And for all of the wonders of modern science and modern medicine, prematurity is still something that can cause grave threats to the fetus and often to the mother as well, in all kinds of ways that the rest of us cannot even imagine. Ted and Christine Yang survived, as did their two other triplets, although living with difficulties of one kind or another. But they have made it through, and they have also never forgotten Raymond, and hence the importance of this book, which Ted Yang has written, called Table for Five, A Father's Story of Life, Love, and Loss. Ted Yang is the son of Chinese immigrants, a serial entrepreneur responsible for more than a dozen different startups and nonprofits. And I am very grateful for this opportunity to speak with Ted Yang about his new book. Ted Yang, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks, Greg, for having me.
I really appreciate this. You talk about how the simple question that can come up quite often in casual meetings about how many kids do you have is so very difficult for you and your wife to answer, and difficult for anybody to answer who has lost a child under any kind of circumstance. And you begin the book there, and obviously it's important to you that you understand, you want us to understand the unintended complexity of that question and why it is so important for you to tell this story. You write at one point, I choose to reveal my story because it defines me and inspires how I approach life and business. Why is this so central to you that it makes you want to share this story so widely?
Yeah, well, I do a lot of lunches, and actually that was the working title of the book, was Lunches with Strangers, because I meet a lot of people. And when you meet people, they want to know you. And a very simple question is asking about your family. But when you lose a child, when you lose someone you love, you know, it becomes a question of, do I want to bring that up and make the entire conversation about that? So having triplets born at 24 weeks was a completely changing experience, as you might imagine. I went from having a kind of pretty defined path and like a good upward trajectory as a hedge fund guy. Completely, we're unable to work for a long period of time because we had to take care of everything for those children. They fought for their lives for years on end. It took 4 years for my daughter to breathe out of her mouth and her nose. And so, when I get asked that question, of course, I have two children that are survivors that we fought so hard to keep alive. And so it's easy for me to say I have two, but the real answer is I have three. But the question is, do I really want to make this lunch about that? Do I really want to make everything about my story? And really, I think usually the answer is yes. Usually I feel that if you don't want to know about me and you don't want to know about what defines me or brought me to become the person that I am, then maybe we shouldn't be doing business together.
Hmm. In what way would you say that this experience has defined you? I mean, that's a really interesting turn of phrase, and I think a lot of important things can happen to us, but they don't necessarily define us. What prompts you to say that this experience has actually defined you, or in what way has this experience defined you?
I think in several ways. I think the most important way is really getting me to accept loss and powerlessness. Right. It's pretty hard for me. I think it's pretty hard for most people and most men to really admit that you don't have control over a situation. I grew up as the son of immigrants. I, kind of was in those classic overachiever, continued to excel and do things, as I said. And at the time in which we had these children, I, was working at the largest hedge fund in the world as an executive and doing quite well. And that's thank God for my health insurance there. And to go from that to a situation where we're, observers mostly, right? And when you watch your children in the NICU and you see that they're suffering and fighting, you're an observer mostly. That's not to minimize the important role that parents have as advocates. In fact, it's critical to make sure that that happens. But mostly, you aren't in control. And to be able to accept that and understand that is defining. And I think that, going further, even in the companies that you say, I started, a dozen plus, which is still an amazing number every time I hear that, wouldn't have happened. I wouldn't have taken risks like that if I didn't come to terms with loss and with the struggles that we had.
Hmm. You say something pretty remarkable very early in the book, namely, for the longest time, I didn't want kids. Tell us, first of all, why that was true. For such a long time, you did not want kids. And then explain what happened or what changed that made it instead something that you did want to make part of your life.
Right. Well, I grew up, again, my parents struggled really hard to get to this country. They both were escaped from the communists from China to Taiwan when they were very little. And they fought, with their families to be able to get ultimately to the United States, right, the promised land. And they both had to go to Canada first and get master's degrees in order to even be let in. It wasn't until the late 60s that the quotas were changed to let people directly into the United States. And so my parents raised me very clearly as, look, we gave up everything to get here. You got to make good on this. Not unusual. I think a lot of first-generation immigrant children are like that. And, it resulted in a pretty hard environment, let's say, right? You've heard of the Tiger Mom thing. You've heard of kind of the standoffish father thing. And I think my parents kind of lived up to those stereotypes. And so for me, when I was younger, I really thought about, do I want to have that be the thing that I pass on to my children? And do I want to be Can I be the kind of father that I think my children would deserve? And my early on answer was no. I thought that I'm a very passionate, intense person. I can be very fiery. I have a temper. I have all of these things that I was, I really said, look, this isn't something that I think would make me a good father. And biology is strong, though, Greg, right? So over time, having met my wife and, girlfriend at the time and just talking through this, it became very clear that I do want to try. I do want to see what, can happen out of that next generation. I do want to, put my hopes and dreams into a little child. And for all that, changed my mind, if you will. Or maybe I always wanted to do that, and I always just doubted my own abilities, and I came to be more at peace with that.
We're speaking with Ted Yang, the author of a memoir called Table for Five, A Father's Story of Life, Love, and Loss. It is the story of Ted Yang and Christine Yang and their triplets, and the one triplet that was lost very soon thereafter, just days after they were born, seriously premature at 24 weeks. It's kind of interesting that we're talking about triplets. In my other life beyond the radio station, I teach at a local college, and just yesterday I learned for the first time that one of my voice students is a triplet. And I realized that he is, I'm pretty sure, the first and only triplet that I have ever met in my life. So that says something about how relatively uncommon triplets are. You tell us, first of all, how rare triplets are, and also the survival rate for triplets, and also the odds that there will be difficulties when someone gives birth to triplets. Share some of that information with our listeners.
Sure. So as part of our story, and this is covered in Table for Five, we went, to get our ultrasound like any other family, and twins run in my wife's family. And so we were kind of hoping for twins. We were thinking that would be kind of cool to have twins. And we went there, and sure enough, they found two heartbeats, and then, of course, they found a third. And that was jaw-dropping, I think, for both of us, because we both knew that the risks go up. We didn't really exactly know how much, they go up. But really, the rates are, and I don't have the exact numbers, but I think it's something like, 3 or 4% of triplets, maybe closer to 5% of triplets don't make it. It's significantly higher than single, and significantly higher for twins. So every time you go up, it's kind of an exponential increase in complications that could result in death, and also in disablement and other bad outcomes. And so we were actually faced with a choice right away, Greg. Do we want to reduce this pregnancy? Because the idea would be two, again, has a significantly higher chance of survival than three. There are, quite a lot of twins these days. I think a lot of that, by the way, these children were natural. We didn't do IVF or anything like that. But you do see quite a few twins around these days. But I think, as you say, triplets are still relatively rare.
It's also interesting to hear about just how often babies are born prematurely. You tell us in your book just about 400,000 children a year, 1 in 10 children are born prematurely. Remind us of what that benchmark is. I mean, at what point a baby being born, are they still premature? And how seriously premature were your triplets?
Yeah, so that statistic is for America. So in the United States, 1 in 10, and there are about 4 million babies born each year. So that's 400,000 babies that are born prematurely. And the definition of that is 37 weeks or earlier. So a full-term birth is 40 weeks. And so 37 is significant enough that those children need to be in the neonatal ICU and the NICU, as we call it, and some portion of those babies are born even earlier. So my children, this is unbelievably 12 years ago when they were born, the edge of survivability was basically 23 weeks. At 23 weeks, it was basically 50-50 about whether they would survive and or have major complications in their lives. At 24 weeks, when my children were born, it was a third, a third, a third. One third of those children die, one third of those children turn out fine, and one third of those children have significant complications, which, as it turned out, was exactly what happened to my children. Nowadays, you hear stories of 22 weeks. I've even heard a story of 21 weeks. So medical science continues to amaze. The way that they can simulate what happens in the womb for now almost half the entire gestation period is amazing.
What do we know about what causes certain babies to be born premature? And is that a complicated answer? I mean, are there an array of reasons or circumstances which cause this? And also, in the case of you and your wife, Christine, do you know if anything in particular caused your triplets to be born prematurely?
Yeah, so the answer here, and I'm not a doctor, but obviously certainly have done my share of research and understanding of what's going on here. They don't really know all the reasons that babies are born premature. Partly, I think, it's due to people having children later, and that certainly causes something with regards to the survivability of those children. Certainly, children that are IVF or other kinds of interventions also can cause prematurity. But broadly speaking, they don't know. It is something that does run in families. It is something that does impact certain groups more than others. Interestingly enough, Greg, they also don't know how to test it. So I have actually worked with a company that is developing diagnostics for trying to figure this out, because right now the strongest indicator that they have that a child will be premature, or could be born premature, I should say, is that that mother has had another one that was born premature. So there's still a lot to be understood about exactly why children are born premature.
So your triplets are born, as we said earlier, at 24 weeks. Explain just how seriously premature that is, and how frightening a moment this was for you and Christine.
Right. So as I said, the survivability statistics at 24 are pretty bad, were pretty bad. What ended up happening was that our children immediately were whisked away to the NICU. So there's a scene in Table for Five where I observe the birth of my children, which was delivered through cesarean. And my wife is on the table, and she really can't see anything because they block off with a sheet, but I can see everything. And the babies come out. They make a little cry, interestingly enough, and then they're gone. So they're immediately brought to separate, you know, ORs and checked out. And then, you know, put immediately into incubators. And it's pretty amazing, you know, the set of things that could go wrong when you're at that age, right? Because, your lungs aren't developed, for example. And so the things that they have to do in terms of drugs, but also therapies, and in order to allow these lungs to grow and develop outside of the womb are amazing. But many children, unfortunately, don't even get a chance to do that. So when when you look at the size of these infants, they're babies. They're you know, 1.5 pounds each. So if you would imagine, the three of them combined were less than I think the average size child. And it's, you know, when their cousins are born and what have you, and 7-8 pound babies, and of course I hear people 9 pound babies, unbelievable. I'm like, wow, you know what? The three of ours didn't even add up to half of that. Right. That's pretty unbelievable. So you can imagine that the whole universe of things that could conceivably go wrong because they're just so undeveloped and so tiny.
So your triplets are born, and as far as you can tell, they are roughly in a similar state. I mean, they are alive, perhaps not entirely well, but you and your wife are hopeful. It is 2 days later that tiny Raymond begins, in your words, to lag behind. Explain to our listeners what what were some of the first signs that there was trouble with little Raymond?
Right. So for some reason, preemie girls do better than preemie boys. So the survival rates are higher, significantly higher. I don't know them offhand right now, but if you, first of all, just think about that and the expectations of what that means, you know, right away, we knew that the boys were going to have a tougher chance than the girls. And so this is Raymond and Daniel. And then as the days started to go by, that came to pass. So the kids started off on their own, but then they had to be put on ventilators. And when I say, you know, the indicators that things were starting to go wrong, what that meant was that the settings required on the ventilators in order to breathe, because the ventilator does all the breathing for the child, right? So it puts in oxygen mixed in with room air at a certain volume, right? Certain number of breaths permitted, if you will, a certain pressure, right? All these interesting settings, and I cover about all that in Table for Five. It's perhaps a little bit too wonky for most people. But anyway, as those settings start to get worse, as the amount of support necessary for keeping the child breathing increases, that's an indicator that things are starting to go wrong. Of course, he's also constantly getting blood work. And so, again, all these different sorts of indicators start to indicate, well, maybe something's not quite right with, you know, the white blood cell count. Maybe something's not quite right, you know, with all these diagnostics that we're indicating of the child. And again, it's interesting because I haven't thought about a lot of this in a long time. I wrote that chapter, you know, a couple of years ago. And now just talking about it with you, it all comes flashing back, right? Mm. All of this information.
Right. Ultimately, little Raymond does not, in a sense, just pass away on his own, but it is at least in part because of a difficult decision that you and your wife made together to, in effect, retract his life support. And this is something you write about so movingly in your book. Just help us try to understand the kind of things that you and Christine had to weigh in your minds in terms of determining what was best for Raymond and best for your young family.
Yeah. Well, I first of all, my experience is, I think, different than others. I'm a very analytical person. You know, I'm an MIT engineer, and that kind of colors my thinking. So before the kids were born, we sat down and we kind of thought through kind of the, you know, if you will, the guideposts of decisions. And I, you know, said, look, you know what, if it turns out that a child has no possibility of a quality of life, you know, it, and then we need to think about whether we would continue to support that child. Again, it was we didn't know how early the children would be, but we strongly knew that they were going to be early and that there were going to be complications. So we set those guideposts. Now, of course, Greg, but that's one thing. And then when it happens, it's quite another, right? And as, you know, Raymond's decline, it, you know, it took him a week. Frankly, he survived a week, which was actually September 11, 2008, after their date, their birth on September 4th. That slide, you know, didn't happen immediately. But then when it started to go, it happened quickly. It was, you know, the increased ventilator settings. It was white blood cell count, which indicated that he had an infection. And that infection is what kills most preemies, which is necrotizing endocolitis, breakdown of the bowels. And they don't really know what causes it. And there are many, many possibilities. They didn't know what actually caused it in his case. There are many possibilities. But what the outcome that everyone dreads is that results in brain bleed. And that actually was something that didn't happen with Raymond. So he started to swell. He started to, you know, the number shot up. He was clearly unwell and unresponsive, fever, all of that. And they, you know, everything they could throw at him, antibiotics-wise and what have you, weren't arresting that. But he did not have a brain bleed. And without a brain bleed, the quality of life was still conceivably good. Unfortunately, in the span of a day, he went from not detecting a brain bleed to what they call a grade 4, which is the highest level of brain bleed, which meant that the blood was just you know, everywhere. That's a scientific way of saying it. Really, at that point in time, the probability that he'd even perhaps gain consciousness is low, and the probability that he would have a normal life of any sort, by measure, is near zero. Mm-hmm. And so at that point, it was not easy, as I said, despite what we thought of earlier, despite, you know, kind of setting some guideposts, it's still not an easy decision. And I talk about that in my book, In Table for Five, about how when I was told about the brain bleed, I was back at work, and, you know, the conversation I had to have with my boss, because, you know, in my mind, that was, you know, he was already gone. Hmm. And so then we went to the hospital. I went to the hospital. My wife was already there. And we made the decision to retract life support. I don't know exactly what was going through my head at the time, but I can tell you it still wasn't easy. Mm-hmm. It's still not an easy thing to give up. It's still not easy for me to give up on anything, frankly. Mm-hmm. But relative to the fact that we had two others that were fighting for their lives, that were consuming resources, our time, our attention, you know, everything. And you know, Raven's what it could mean if he could even survive, and it wouldn't be good for him. And that ultimately was that. It wasn't about the other kids. It wasn't about everyone else. It wasn't about us and what we were willing to sacrifice. It was about, would he be happy? Would he have a happy life? And when it, you know, that wasn't possible, that's when we made that call. Hmm.
One of the things you say about when you left the hospital, and this is, I think, before you knew the full scope of just how serious things were, you write, "I think I was already saying goodbye to a child I had barely met." I was thinking, I've continued to think about those haunting words and what it feels like to have to, in a sense, say farewell to, in your words, somebody you have barely met, and yet someone who is so incredibly important to you. What is that kind of goodbye like?
I don't know how to characterize it. I don't have much to compare it against. I think the other people that have died in my life have lived full lives. My grandfather died at 100. You know, I do think it was brief, the goodbye. It had to be brief because we had two children. I mean, the hardest part, I think, for me, wasn't the goodbye at the time. Wasn't the goodbye. It was having to go back to the room where he died the next day because I had two other children there, right, fighting through their lives. That was really, really hard for me. I think that in terms of the, you know, his life and understanding that, I still don't. It's just all potential, right? It's all of what could have been. And it's also, you know, partly, again, reflecting the mirror of perhaps, you know, my own hubris, my wife and I, saying that we want to keep all three, we want to fight all the way, right? Did that lead to his death? I grapple with this in the book. And I don't have a full answer. I of course feel responsible because perhaps I want to have some agency in something that I intellectually shouldn't have agency in, right? I mean, as I said, we're mostly powerless observers as to what happened to him. Mm-hmm. And so, how do you say goodbye to that? I don't know, Greg. It was something that happened, and then we're back in the NICU, and then years later, I think I first was starting to properly grieve, but I'm still grieving.
Hmm. And this moment when you and Christine lose your precious Raymond happens to be the 11th of September. So a date already drenched with grief for you, and of course now drenched with an even deeper and more personal kind of grief. In the wake of Raymond's death, you have of course gone on to parent both Sophie and Daniel, and each of them have had to contend with various challenges and issues, I'm sure, related to their own premature births as well. What has this journey been like for you as a family, for the four of you, and what would be a couple of the most important lessons that you have learned along the way?
Right. Well, absolutely. The kids are 12 now, and which is unbelievable to me, and that this happened a while ago. We had to parent them both, and Sophia, you know, much of the book is about Sophia's story, because it took, again, 4 years and many major surgeries before she could breathe through of her mouth and her nose. And because of that, her voice is not normal. It's very soft. It's very raspy. It's difficult for her to communicate. Other problems associated with her prematurity have resulted in some physical disabilities for her. And for my son Daniel, he has autism, which is correlated with prematurity, but probably not caused by. It does also tend, I think there's some signals and markers in my family, which I discuss in Table for Five. He has to grapple with that. The babies that are born prematurely, especially those that are born severely prematurely like mine, tend to have developmental delays. So while my children are 12, they act, kind of in terms of maturity and in terms of their ability to interact with us in the world, kind of like they're 9 and 10. And that just becomes this ongoing thing, this ongoing part of our story. And I think that, what I want people to know about that, what I want people to learn from that, is that there's so much joy in your children, no matter who they are or what they are. And the struggles and all of these things that happen, talking about them now, right, when I'm writing about them and describing them, seem monumental, even to me. I lived through it, right? And you go through it. You get past it. And I really think that everyone's struggle is unique, but you are still not alone. We talked about how many parents go through something like a story like mine because of prematurity. But child loss and special needs and all these things happen to a lot of parents. And I think the most important thing is you are not alone. We are parenting. And all the things that we do would not have been possible if it wasn't for the people that are around us or surrounding us that are helping us and helping Daniel and Sophia grow and develop.
Mm. And I should mention that your book includes a lovely dedication to one of the most important doctors in this story and one of the most important nurses, both of whom are no longer with us, but you wanted to be sure to express great appreciation to them, and of course to everybody else who has been with you on this difficult journey. The book again is Table for Five, A Father's Story of Life, Love, and Loss, and the author, Ted Yang. Ted Yang, thank you so much for sharing with the world this story and for being part of today's morning show. I was really honored to speak with you. Best wishes to you and to your family.
Thank you so much, Greg. It was a pleasure speaking to you.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm not sure that the topic for this portion of The Morning Show could be more timely. It is anxiety, something that so many of us are experiencing, and many of us, for multiple reasons, for a host of different reasons, we are feeling anxiety. Some of us probably among the highest levels of anxiety that we have ever experienced in our adult lives. And we're going to be spending the next few minutes talking with Elke Scholtz, who is a registered psychotherapist and also a registered expressive art consultant, and someone who has worked with all kinds of people on various matters related to wellness and especially in managing anxiety and depression. And she has written a new book called Anxiety Warrior, in which she outlines some of her thoughts about anxiety and the best ways to manage it. Elke Scholtz, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to share.
Well, I'm glad we can have this this conversation. You are joining us from Ontario, Canada, and it's interesting. Sometimes people like to think in a broad, simplistic way of Canadians as being easygoing, and yet it's foolish to think that Canadians would be any more immune to anxiety than the rest of us. And you actually say in your book that anxiety has been a very significant part of your life, although especially early in your life, you didn't always even really know that or understand that. Tell us more about your long personal history with anxiety.
Well, one of the things is that we didn't call it anxiety when I was growing up, and that actually comes up today when I do talks. People ask me, you know, what's the difference between anxiety versus stress? And I don't know if we really need to articulate it, except that we have that uneasy, nervous feeling, and we're very stressful. And so what happened to me as a child, I was one of those kids that had migraines and tummy aches and flu-y feelings, and jeepers, it coordinated with, you know, an upcoming project or a test. And my dad used to think I was faking it. My mom was a little more sympathetic, and I guess down the road, too, realized that she had anxiety. Then as a teenager, I stuttered quite a bit, and sometimes I still do as an adult when I get excited, and I switch my letters around, and, you know, we just roll with it now. I don't beat myself up so much for it anymore. And what goes along with anxiety is depression. And I remember in my early 20s and 30s that I used to feel like I was hiding this big secret. And people saw me as probably pretty calm. I did go to my own drummer, but I always felt like I was hiding something, and that something was really terribly wrong with me. So fast forwarding, you know, to adult and then going back to school and realizing that, you know, I read a book and realizing that I had anxiety and there were strategies for that. And then noticing that as I have my private practice, as most of my clients that come in have some kind of anxiety that stops them from either working or enjoying their lives. And that's how I came about to, you know, formulating layers. Where did this all come from, and can we manage it? And I'm just such a practical person, and when something is very accessible and simple, I grab onto it. And I started making lists and started doing talks and realizing that we could manage it, and also realizing that that's all I had was anxiety, and I could manage it, I could change it, I could make it smaller in my life.
I thought it was interesting, the turn of phrase that you say at one point, I was determined to change channels.
Yes.
I think that's a really, and I think you can think about that in a couple different ways. I mean, it's changing the channel on the TV or changing the channel that your boat is traveling down in terms of rivers and streams. You also
absolutely.
You also mentioned, by the way, that it, before you had your anxiety under control, you had a what would amount to, I should think, a really, really serious sleep disorder, in
yes.
which for months on end you were essentially not sleeping at all.
Yeah,
so,
2 years actually.
So what was it that ultimately allowed you to change channels? I mean, was it just developing an awareness of your own anxiety and then just coming to grips with it? Is it, at least at the outset, as simple as that?
Well, there's a couple things, Craig. What you can do, what I noticed is there was one day, and I don't know if people remember, if listeners remember the gray, silver Ford Sable station wagon with the red stripe down the center of it. Anyways, I was driving that down the highway on this beautiful sunny day, and I remember feeling really good. And then within about 20 minutes, I started to feel terrible and stressed and anxious. And what I noticed was nothing had changed. The road was still good. Everything was fine except that 20 minutes had passed. And I thought to myself, you know what? These are my thoughts. And so at that point in time, and that was kind of a turning point for me, is I just went, you know what, I'm going to change channels. And I didn't have, you know, any technical language or neuroscience language or any of that. And yet it just works really well. And I decided just to change my thoughts. And so I just dreamed up this funny fantasy, and I started feeling better. And that was really powerful because I realized, you know, I could do that because I didn't have to ruminate on something. And that's a strategy that we can use. And we have 50 to 70,000 thoughts a day, and most of those are repetitive. And a lot of those thoughts really don't change our environment or our life per se. So we can control that. We can decide how we're going to think about things, and it's a fabulous strategy.
Hmm. We're speaking with Elka Scholz about her book, Anxiety Warrior. You spend the first part of the book talking about what anxiety is, and I think all of us in sort of its essence understand what anxiety is, but you go on to specify the many different types of anxiety and, in a sense, the levels of anxiety and the fact that anxiety can vary in terms of its debilitating effect. And I suppose that's one thing that's a little complicated about all this, is that it is possible to experience fairly normal anxiety that probably is a fairly normal, maybe even necessary part of life, versus anxiety that truly disables a person.
Yes, and I understand that it may sound complicated, though one of the things that I find really powerful is when you understand something, it doesn't become so ominous. When you understand where it's coming from or where you might fit in that, then you can do something about it. It's when it's so unknown, and what I discovered is there's about 11 places, layers, I call them layers, where anxiety comes from. That sounds kind of big. However, when you look at the layers, nine of them, you can change almost immediately. So that makes it very accessible and hopeful. And when you understand, when you kind of look at some of the different types of anxiety, you might sit there and go, well, I might be a little bit of this or a little bit of that. However, then you can do something about it, and that's the good part.
I think what is really intriguing in your book is the portion that talks about 11 layers of anxiety. Explain to our listeners why you think it is helpful to take apart anxiety in this way and to understand its various layers, and maybe identify at least some of those 11 layers for our listeners.
Oh yeah, very happy to. One of the things I noticed with my own anxiety and as I started down this path of discovery was I'd wake up with anxiety and then try and figure out where it came from, and I thought, oh yeah, I found the reason, and it went away pretty quickly within seconds. So that's pretty powerful when you find you have mornings or days or sometimes weeks of feeling ill and sick to your stomach. So then what I realized is, when that strategy or that illumination wasn't working, it's puzzling. And immediately a human nature is to think you've done something wrong or you failed. And so when I noticed when my clients were coming in, they were having the same experience. Most people think that, you know, that they're doing something wrong or they haven't figured it out or, you know, something is going on, and we really can do something about it. So one of the simplest ones is substances, and as simple as water. We sweat a lot during the night. And if you find that you wake up in the morning and that's when you're typically anxious, one of the things you can do is just drink about a quarter cup of water, not very much, and within minutes that anxiety goes away because the brain will signal the body with anxiety-like symptoms if it's dehydrated. And so many of my clients will use that strategy, and even if it's only one portion of or one kind of layer for you, it lowers your anxiety. So it's just so simple to do. And then, of course, things like caffeine and sugar and carbohydrates sometimes deplete the water or the water in the body, as does alcohol and cigarettes. So we just need to be mindful of that our bodies, you know, need that hydration. So that's one of the layers. Another one is physical. We need exercise. We need those wonderful endorphins. We need to understand if we're not getting enough sleep. We need sleep. If anybody and anyone listening to this, make sure you're getting lots of sleep. Somebody asked me last week, their teenager was actually sleeping many, many hours, maybe, you know, 14 hours. They said, let them sleep. We need our sleep. And we don't sleep like that all the time. However, there are times we do need our sleep. We do need to nap, is give in to that. Your body needs that. And it's one of the easiest ways to rejuvenate yourself and gain good health.
Mm-hmm. Your book is replete with all kinds of helpful suggestions on how to deal with anxiety, including the suggestion of awakening and immediately doing a mental checklist, which you talk us through in some detail. It's a very, very helpful book. I wonder if you can just say a quick word about the particular anxieties of this moment. And right, yes. Yeah. And if your advice about anxiety is maybe especially applicable, or if we should be thinking about anxiety in different ways right now, given all that is going on.
Well, that's a really great question, Greg. And yes, there are definitely things that we can do to feel better right away. And one of the things that's in the book is, you'll see there's this a smorgasbord of ideas, and that reasoning is that each body, each of us, we're different. So one of the things is, you know, one strategy might really work great for you. Another strategy is really going to work great for me. So it's kind of experimenting, getting to know who you are. And one of the particular things that we can do right now immediately is being present. And when we look at what's present in our life, like right now, I'm in my studio. It's actually, we're having fabulous weather right now. I'm going to be working outside in my garden, and I'm healthy, and looking at the things that we do have in our life right now. And I know that a lot of us are facing all kinds of different hardships, and it's really stretching us creatively to find gratitude in these moments, yet we still can do that. I mean, we're breathing, we're alive, you know, we can be so basic in being present and, you know, having relationships and connections, and even like this radio show, you know, it's I'm so grateful for it, and we can reach out to each other and being present. And then the other strategy, and I call it, actually it's not my design, it's from our Board of Education up here. However, it's so easy to remember, it's called Feed All Four. And the four is mental, physical, emotional, and spiritual. And, you know, we need to look at how can we feed our mental, how can we feed our minds, and feeding means enhancing, inspiring, being creative. You know, we need to stretch ourselves a little bit more. We need to dig deeper. How can we physically take care of ourselves in the best way that we can? Emotionally, how do we connect? How do we, you know, make that eye contact, smile, and be inspired, feeling better about our lives? And spiritual, you know, what's our spiritual connection? How do we get connected again with our spirituality, with nature, with this planet? And if we can keep focusing on that and striving to be the best that we can be in those areas, that would be a great strategy.
The book, again, is Anxiety Warrior. It's published by The Artist's Reply. The author is Elka Scholz. Elka Scholz, thank you so much for giving the world this potentially very helpful book, and thank you for being part of the morning show.
Thank you so much. An honor. True honor. Thank you.
Tomorrow on the morning show, Abraham Lincoln expert Steve Rogsted talks about his new book, which traces some of the connections between Abraham Lincoln and Mary Todd Lincoln and Wisconsin, including right here in southeastern Wisconsin. It's also an examination of the many artifacts of Lincoln in Wisconsin and the many statues, including the full story behind that striking statue which adorns the campus of